Good morning. It's Tuesday, April 22nd, and you are listening to The Morning Voice. The Morning Voice, 5 days a week from 7 to 9 on KVOI 1030. Five different hosts, five different focuses, and five different conversations. So I encourage you to listen in to The Morning Voice every day. I am Ted Maxwell. Today is Tuesday, and civic engagement and trying to help get everyone involved is what we focus on. So we talk a lot local, a lot about government, and a lot about how people can get engaged, whether it's through service to their community, to their neighborhood, to their place of worship, to nonprofits, or if they're willing to take the next step and actually get involved and serve in many different capacities, from first responders, healthcare workers, to even elected officials. So with me behind the glass is Matt Neely. He is the one who keeps me on time and on target.
But I can't help you with printers. Your epic battle with the printer this morning. God. But
One of the running jokes is I learned this from one of my mentors, Christy Simone, that you run into the office, 5 minutes before the show, and let's make it happen. Let's go. obviously, I could use a little more prep than that. But Matt, this morning, I was up early. I was out of the house early. I went by the office to print stuff out that we needed for the, that I needed sure. for the show. And yeah. I go, I'm going to shock Matt. I'm going to be here by like 6:35. Unfortunately, me and the printer didn't get along. And I didn't figure that out till I was already in my car driving to the studio back to the office. Long story short, it's been one of those days, and I'll blame it all on yesterday.
It's okay.
All
right. It's Monday. Holdover. The joke used to be Chris versus the cables, because he had problems with cables on your side of the glass. And you can be Ted versus the printer. It's okay.
It's often
versus the printer, by the way. So I think we're kindred souls in that regard.
I think it might come down to my wife's opinion. It's just Ted versus planning. Really? I had to run by the office to print everything out this morning? As when I came in this morning, Matt talked to me about yesterday was an RTA meeting, which was also a PAG meeting. It was a little combative.
Contentious.
It was contentious. There's a lot of discussions, lots going on. But probably the biggest thing I'd want the listeners to know is the decision or the acknowledgement yesterday to put the election off. We're now targeting March of 2026.
For RTA next?
For RTA next.
So that would be an off-cycle election?
It would be. The options, here's the three options we had, Matt. I know you're back there shaking your head.
There's an election coming up.
Here you go. So November is a possibility.
Sure.
We could do it on the city's ballot. Now remember, then it's the city's ballot. It's not a big one. On July 1st, 2026, if we have not approved RTA next, what happens? Absent sales tax stops.
So you can't do the 2026 general election that
we,
is so already
we can't.
Happening.
That would be too late. It would be too late.
Did you say July 1st or 31st?
July 1st.
Okay.
It ends June 30th.
You can't even do the primary that one then.
No. And the challenge is the way the legislature changed our specific regional transportation, if we don't do it prior to the funding, no matter when we do it, no matter if it's a November election, April election, it starts the next May. So our three choices remaining is November, which we'd have to have a plan by this May.
Okay.
That's not going to happen. Yeah. So November's really off the table. So then it becomes March. And if March, then that May 1st, we can start collecting the continuation of the tax. If we go for the mid-May election, we can't initiate the new tax until the following May 1st, which means we go 11 months. So a year without any, and everything that we're finishing, anything that we want to start, there's no funding coming in. So it really is a timing issue, and it does need to get to the voters in March. And so we're trying to focus, and we're trying to not let everything else distract us. And that's going to be, it's going to be my push. I mean, I'm a huge RTA Next advocate. I've been on multiple radio shows talking about it, and I'm going to continue talking on this one, because I believe it's one of the few things we have here that's regional. Everything else is falling into the city conundrums. And right now, not all the mayors are getting along, per se. I mean, they do a good job at it. They're all elected officials. They get it. They're professional. They go through that. But there's not a lot of agreement in what's best both in the plan and for the community. My biggest fear is when we have 36% of our citizens living in unincorporated Pima County, there's no way to address them. So if all the municipalities want to go on their own, we're going to have things going on in different locations, but it won't be a regional approach. And I don't think any of us really go, oh, I'm passing through Oro Valley's border with unincorporated Pima County as I'm driving down Oracle. Oh, now I'm entering the city. But roads don't recognize boundaries.
Well, and even if they do understand that, they also know that if the road system is not up to date in some way, or it's lacking in some major improvement that a regional thing could fund, they know that their transportation is being affected, whether they know exactly if they're in a county island or county area or whatever.
No, absolutely. And there's a lot of important things to get out. You hear the arguments you hear in the press or on the radio or on TV comes down to, you know, more transit, more buses, less cars, or more roads, you know, cars are good, all that. And that's gotta be worked out. And there's plenty of Ted's opinion. There's plenty of funding in the current RTA Next plan to continue to support the transit system as it exists today. There's probably a shortage of funds to do what we really want to do on the roadways, but that's a fact of life. As a taxpayer, we've all got our limit on what we want to contribute to that. And I think the half cent is the sweet spot. It's what we've had for 20 years. It's what we can continue. It is legally a new tax.
It works in other areas as well.
Yes, it does.
In other regional areas, like, I don't know, the Valley of the Sun.
That might be one.
It does.
It does work in other regional areas. And it works really well there. And what I recognized the other day is that in Maricopa, they have to go to the legislature to get their half cent put on the ballot. So all 29 of those mayors together, they bond together because their common enemy, we'll just use that loosely.
Sure.
Their common enemy is the legislature.
Unites a group of people like a common enemy,
yeah,
right? They can make up a common enemy.
But you know, in PAG, because we don't have to do that, who becomes the common enemy? It's all internal. It's all internal. And I think we've got to get past that. We've got to understand that this region, and I say region, and we've talked about this before, you know, when you're back east, you say, where are you from? Oh, I'm from Tucson, Arizona. Well, I live in Oro Valley, but I'm from Tucson. Because that's something that everybody knows. And we need to embrace that. We need all of the county to become better. And the only way we're going to do that is through cooperation. We've seen it with years and years of battle with the policies and laws and what the city's doing and what their focus is versus maybe what Marana or Sarita want. They're different. And they're different. There are different economic makeups. There are different political makeups throughout the region. But the bottom line is we all live in this one town and this one giant community. And when we try to get somewhere, we're all impacted by the decisions we make as a region. And right now, most of the arguments seem to be about what's in it for. And this is not just RTA. This is water. You look at the charging the water rates outside of the city. You look at wastewater. All the municipalities there's arguing going on, and there always will be. You know, there always going to be competition.
Sure.
But what I'd like to see is that competition be for the economic development. So, I mean, you go north to the Valley of the Sun, a company comes in to look at that, and they've got five or six different communities pitching them on why they should come to them and how they can work with them. And that's going to lead to job growth. That's going to lead to opportunities. SALC is, we've always said that you address poverty, you address crime, you address other issues in the community through jobs and opportunity. And we just don't have enough of that right now. There's not enough business growth. We've lost, you know, manufacturing has boomed in this state in the last 10 years. A record level of manufacturing job growth, but in Pima County, it's been flat. So, and some of that's because they come down here and they don't see the cooperation. They don't see the collaboration. Oh, and by the way, they see the roads. And that doesn't lead a company to a good feeling of wanting to come down and settle here.
And companies come here and oftentimes get lectured by municipalities. I'm sorry, municipality.
The fact of the matter is too often we've heard, and I've seen this, the municipalities are asking, or municipalities asking, so what are you going to do for us? You're not, that doesn't encourage companies to say, this is a warm and open environment. We talk a lot about, you know, everybody says, politicians, every politician will always say they're business friendly. And if I was a politician, I'd say I was business friendly too. But there's a difference between the ease of business and being business friendly.
And this goes back decades, and it's long before you lived here, and it's long before I lived here, but I lived up the street in the Valley of the Sun. And the movement here for decades has been no growth. No growth. The no growthers ran this place in the 60s and 70s. No growth, no growth. We don't want to be Phoenix. We don't want to be LA. We don't want to be Phoenix. We want to be Tucson. Every opportunity, every fork in the road they came to, no growthers had their thumb on the scale. That's why Motorola was going to put a 5,000 person operation at what was it? Orange Grove and Shannon, you know, in 1970. And the no growthers won that one. Decades later, decades of 5,000 plus jobs in Austin, Texas, where the plant actually ended up going, right? Making, at the time, integrated circuits and now chips and things like, or whatever it is like that they're doing now. But the theme of Tucson, that's why there's no regional freeway system, because the no growthers won that one, okay? That's why the big push to put a damper on development, because the no growthers won that one. And so here we are, you know, again, a freeway system is a regional approach. A freeway system that would go from Vail to Marana, you know, maybe along riverbeds or something like that, or a midtown freeway or something like that. All of those require regional approaches, because you are going through county islands along the way, right? But the no growthers, and this is, they got what they wanted, Ted. And I think, unfortunately, here we are decades later, and we're like, well, why can't we grow? It's like, well, because the no growthers got what they wanted.
And the infrastructure is what's needed to support business growth,
yep,
employment growth, and growth in the community. And we don't have that. And if we lose the RTA, we're going to have even less. So, well, you've heard the Matt and Ted morning rant on this, the Morning Voice on 10:30, The Voice. Looks like our caller, we're going to be joined by Jaime Molera after the break, and we will discuss speaking of stagnation, what's going on up right now at the state legislature and what we have to look forward to in 2026. So thank you for joining us, and please stay around and enjoy the rest of the conversation. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I am Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass, and I am very pleased and very grateful that we're now being joined by Jaime Molera. Jaime, how are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Ted. I'm fantastic. Thank you.
Outstanding. I really appreciate you stepping into this. Jaime just got the call yesterday. I said, hey, I've got an opening, and Jaime's a kind of a frequent flyer with us. He's the one of the founding partners with Molera Alvarez. I always love looking through your bio to see some things. And what I want to make the listeners know today is at one point you were one of the 50 most influential leaders in Arizona, according to the Arizona Business Journal. And you've been recognized as one of the top 100 Hispanic leaders in the United States by Hispanic Business Magazine. So
thank you. That doesn't mean very much, but otherwise,
well,
I appreciate it.
Well, what it means now is you get to be down at the state legislature grinding to try to make sure things keep moving and things happen and support the organizations that put their trust in you, like SALC does. So Jaime, let's just go straight to it. There's a whole lot of it seems like almost at a standstill right now up at the state legislature. Mm-hmm. It was rolling for the first couple months. Things were going fast. We were talking about an early budget. And now, because of some funding issues, things have come to kind of mm-hmm. a standstill. So can you kind of fill us in on what things are looking like right now?
Well, you're right. Things have ground to a halt. Right now, there's two big issues, I think, that are left. One is dealing with this shortfall in developmental disabilities funding. There was a significant growth in this population that the state funds, really related to a lot of kids with autism, a lot of, unfortunately, a big boon in that area. So they found themselves in a $122 million shortfall. Governor comes to the legislature, says we need this money in order to keep this program solvent. Of course, the legislature, the politics get in the way, and it's they haven't been able to find a timely solution. Now, the clock is ticking because on Wednesday, the 24th, if they don't do it, then the program doesn't have the money to fund these programs and these services, mainly for these kids. So you see a big, big escalation of advocates down at the Capitol. You see a lot of back and forth between who's to blame, the governor versus the legislature. And so, unfortunately, that's bogged things down. And then it leads to the next big piece that they have to deal with, which is the budget, which I'll talk about in a second. But that really, this week, is what they're talking about.
And so my understanding out of it is that a lot of the shortfall became not just obviously the diagnosis, but they also significantly increased the number of parents who received training to be qualified as the caretakers for their children. Is there any pushback from either side of the aisle on that's not something we should be doing, or what has led? I mean, like you said, $122 million. The governor's threatened to veto every bill that comes to her desk until they have a solution, bipartisan solution to this. Where do you see the hangups being?
And you're right. And that's a big piece of this. I think things are also slowed down because the legislature knows that if they send bills to the governor, they automatically get vetoed, regardless of whose bill it is and what the bill does, which I think the governor should have done, in my opinion, a while ago. But having said that, that's creating the stalemate that we have right now. I think one of the things, too, that's created this, that's going to be difficult to move away from. When we went through COVID, we being the state and, of course, the feds, instituted a lot of COVID-era policies that weren't normal. And one of the things was, is because we couldn't get groups together during that time, they paid parents directly to provide the services in the home, which, of course, increased the cost significantly. So instead of having maybe 15 people come to a group therapy, you have to do that individually now, which jacked up the prices quite a bit. The people in the system, though, like that process, and people have become very fond of it. And that's why the state has been, in my opinion, a little bit reticent to take that away. But at some point, that's going to happen. I think they're going to have to look at all these COVID-era policies that have remained in place that have really driven up the budget. And I'm not sure it can be sustained, because, of course, we used to pay for that with all these federal dollars that were flowing into the state. Well, that's gone away for a while now. And I think that's something they're going to have to deal with here fairly soon.
Well, I think that's a great point. And obviously, during COVID, this was something that was necessary. The money helps augment some of the costs that the parents were taking on, which could have normally been provided through some state funded to the partners and the organizations that would care for kids with the special needs. And so it's a challenge. You mentioned the budget. Mm-hmm. What I mean, last time you were on the show, I think we were talking about seeing a budget early. What do you think the next steps for the budget, or do they have to get through this this first issue before they can address the rest of the budget?
Well, I think there's two issues. One is just the overall revenue that's certainly shrunk over the last several months, but it's also the politics, not just between a Democrat governor and a Republican legislature. It's between the Republicans themselves. They can't seem to get their act together and coming up with a unified plan that they would present in front of Governor Hobbs. So I think there's some, there's not a unified approach from the Republican standpoint, which I think is leading to problems. But the revenue shortfall, I think, is a real one. Recently, the legislature has a finance advisory committee, and that's mainly economists, university researchers that really look at the overall economic health of Arizona, and they look at all the data. Well, long story short, they had a revenue estimate for this year that we would see about a $612 million surplus. Well, they lowered that estimate to $277 million. And that's pretty significant from the time they met 3 months ago to now. I mean, and they also were very concerned, and the current Legislative Budget Committee's executive director issued a dire warning to the legislature. Look, it's not only that revenues have fallen, But we do see, and of course we're seeing across the country, because of the concern over tariffs and because of the trade wars that are going on, there's a very, very real possibility of a recession. So that's why a lot of folks are really encouraging the legislature and the governor be very careful in spending too much in this budget, because we might have to come back in short order and make drastic cuts like we've done we had to do a couple of years ago when they spent like drunken sailors, and then they had to come back and make massive cuts. I think there's a lot of concern over that happening again.
Well, I know Senator Kavanaugh came out the other day and said he's concerned with it, that there's been a lot of things that have gone through probes, but a lot of the bets will be off if these reductions continue. And so far, it's looking like we're going to be impacted.
I think we are. I think we are. And I think that's just not Jaime Mueller saying that. I think even the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, has talked about, look, you know, there's some pretty dire signs ahead, warning signs ahead. So we just need to be careful on how we set these budgets that could impact us down the road.
Absolutely. And that's the voice of Jaime Mueller with Mueller Alvarez. You're listening to 1030 The Voice. Stay with us. We've got the bottom of the hour break, and we'll be right back. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, Matt Neely behind the glass. And we still have Jaime Mueller with us, thankfully. Jaime, sorry about that long break. If you don't mind, I might keep you a little bit longer, but when you need to go, you let me sure. You let me know. I do appreciate you being on with me. And to your point on the, before we drop off the budget issue, you talked about the FAC, which is the group that gets together and talks about the budget, and they actually decided to disregard the U of A's estimates completely when they were talking about this recently to make their adjustments to the thing. And Alan McGuire, George Hammond, who runs the MAP dashboard as well as the EBRC down here, he basically said they're right to, because everything's moving so quickly that the numbers are changing so fast, so quickly.
Right.
What any more thoughts on the budget, on how or what you think they need to do to get to one that's going to both get agreement from the governor and be able to get through?
Well, I think caution is the word and is the approach that they should take, because if they were to just fund the growth in K-12 education, just inflation and student growth, the growth that has occurred in the state Medicaid programs and some of the big items that tend to dominate Arizona's budget. Yes, you're not going to have a lot of money for all of the other things that folks would like to see happen, whether it's university funding, infrastructure, water issues. And there are some things that need to be addressed, no doubt. But I think that the legislature should be very cautious, because when we are in these situations and we just disregard the warning signs, and then they institute a budget that's, you know, way, way over, and they find themselves in a deficit, then the measures that they take tend to be more harmful to those areas that, you know, that are really significant, K-12 being the biggest target of that. And we saw that, you know, over the years where unfortunately, Arizona was very aggressive in their budget policies, and they weren't very cautious. And next thing you know, they're making massive reductions at all levels. You know, they take, instead of a scalpel, they have to take an axe to certain things. And I just think if they're cautious now, yes, there's going to be disappointment that we're not dealing with some of these key issues, but we're not going to be in such a hole, Ted, that, you know, in the next hopefully year or 2 years, we'll be able to come back and we'll be able to deal with that. But that's what I think that they should be looking at.
And I think that's great advice. I truly hope they listen to you. We were talking during the break, Matt and I, about how in the past we've had this where they've overspent. Then, you know, we've even had to have the time when we went back with a sales tax under Governor Brewer to try to offset the cuts in education that all of a sudden they realized they needed to get back in place. And obviously all your experience in education brings that to the highlight as well.
Yes, well, we'll see what happens. A lot of times, moderation and good judgment doesn't always dominate. I know you're surprised about that, but it doesn't always dominate the Arizona legislative process.
Well, there may be another thing playing into this, too. I mean, I'd like to go into this topic. There are a lot of folks that are already starting to line up for state-level candidacy for, you know, everything from governor, and treasurer was announced yesterday on the Republican side. What all are you seeing, and is this earlier than normal, or is this pretty much what's become the norm for people getting and making their intentions?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's the norm. We're in a perpetual campaign cycle. It seems like we just finished the last one, but the next one starts, you know, the next day, it seems like. So, yes, I think folks are definitely positioning themselves. You're seeing both parties gearing up, both parties having their own internal fights. Just recently, there was this big blow up amongst the Democrats where their state party chairman, Robert Branscombe, got into it with basically hiring an executive director that nobody else wanted. The two U.S. senators made it clear that they were not happy. He went to social media to come out and say how he's not going to be threatened by U.S. senators. The governor, the two U.S. senators, Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, along with Adrian Fuentes, the Secretary of State, and even the Attorney General, for the first time kind of got together. And this might have been the one thing that brought them together, because they're not known to have that cohesive a relationship. But really eviscerated the statements of their party chair. So it's interesting, there's all this infighting that's going on. And of course, on the Republican side, you have the same thing when Andy Biggs, current congressman, is starting to position himself against Karen Taylor Robeson. So there's a lot of moving pieces that we're going to have to look at this year and getting ready for the election of 26.
So what announcements have either surprised you or you think are having the most impact right now on the political situation and our ability to move forward?
Well, certainly for the Republicans, the biggest one that just came out was, and it wasn't that surprising. A lot of folks, I expected that. It was President Trump, who had endorsed very early on Karen Taylor Robeson for governor, came out in social media and said, you know, I still think the world of KTR, but this guy Andy Biggs is a great guy. I love him, and I'm going to endorse him too. So now all of a sudden you have the president endorsing both of them. And everything being equal, I think that really helps Congressman Biggs, because as expected, there was a poll that was done by Club for Growth, a very conservative national organization. And they found that Andy Biggs right now, as it sits, I mean, this, we're not even in the first inning yet, but it just shows that he's up in the polls of 45% support versus Karen Taylor Robeson has 16%. With 39% undecided. So I think the Republican base, certainly backed by Trump, I think that's going to be very powerful for Andy Biggs.
Did you say 45 to 16?
Yes. Yeah, this is a recent, just came out, Club for Growth poll that was done. And remember, that's not that surprising in that Andy Biggs has been around, even though so has Karen, Andy's been around for quite a long time, been very popular amongst the Republican faithful, very conservative. Some see him as kind of a Kerry Lake point two, but I tend to disagree. I think he is very, very conservative. He's very tied to President Trump and the MAGA movement, but he's also very articulate. Very intelligent man. He's had a lot of experience in state and local politics. So he'll be fairly formidable. And on top of that, with President Trump now saying, yes, you know, I bless both of them, everything else being equal, that really bodes well for Andy Biggs.
It absolutely does, because Congressman Biggs was saying that that was going to happen and everybody else was trying to downplay it, that it wasn't. Mm-hmm. It was already done.
So, Jaime, this is Matt. You see this as a more of a calming influence in the primary. My initial take on this was it's going to throw the primary into a chaotic state. You see it as just more of a, hey, both of these are acceptable candidates and I'm okay with either of them?
Well, it depends how hard in my opinion, Karen Taylor Robeson wants to fight. If she puts in the resources that she did against Kerry Lake 4 years ago, which was over 30-some million dollars. I mean, it was a pretty expensive campaign. She lost, but it was very, very tight, and it was very acrimonious, as we recall. But if she can't get that momentum, I think there's going to be a lot of people that would urge her to not do that, so that Republicans don't have that same kind of an inter-party fight. Because remember, usually these midterm elections tend to bode well for the party that's not in power, in this case, the Democrats. I think they're looking at all the chaos that's happening in D.C. and across the country, and they're licking their chops, thinking, okay, now we're going to come back and we're going to win everything. So Republicans, to have a better game plan and to be organized, is going to be, I think it's going to be needed. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And if people just say, you know what, Karen, we like you a lot, we think you're great, but let's rally around the congressman because that's our best chance.
So I mean, I've got a question, if you've got time, on Secretary Fontes. He at one point announced that he was thinking about running against Governor Hobbs, but that kind of died down. Mm-hmm. Then he said he was going to throw his hat in the CD7 race down here to replace the late Raul Grijalva. And then he mm-hmm. decided he wasn't going to do that. What do you think his intentions are?
Well, I think he's in a pretty strong position right now. By all accounts, after he's become Secretary of State, you know, over the last several past secretaries, there's been some controversy around that office, and there's been a lot of discord about how elections have been done. But by and large, people have given him, Republicans and Democrats, have given him high marks on running that office. Secretary of State, as much as they might want to become more political, its job is very just bureaucratic. You know, there's all the lobbying oversight, the campaign oversight, the business filings. I mean, there's some fairly mundane things that have to be done, but you have to have somebody that's organized. And so far, he's done a fairly good job. So out of all the Democrat statewide elected officials right now, I would say he has the best chance of retaining that seat. I think there's going to be Governor Hobbs certainly is going to be in a very, very tough race. I think Attorney General Chris Mays is also going to be in a very, very tough race. Not to say that Adrian won't, but I think because he's done a fairly good job and seems to be fairly popular, I could see him maybe wanting to stay there, Ted. And if he retains it, he might have the possibility of being the only statewide Democrat that's left standing, which, of course, bodes well for him in his future.
Yeah, and I know he did announce that he's going to stay where he is, and he wants to continue in that role. So I think you're right there. You brought up Chris Mays, and I may have got one last question, then we'll let you get on with your day. I know you're incredibly busy, and I appreciate your time. Mm-hmm. But you brought up Chris Mays. So State Senate President Warren Peterson has announced that he's running for Attorney General. How do you see that playing out? But maybe more importantly, how do you see that impacting the rest of this legislative session?
So, yes, Warren Peterson is definitely running for Attorney General. I think he's going to be a very tough candidate. Rodney Glassman, we all know Rodney for many years. He used to be a councilman down in Tucson. Is also running for the Republican side, but I would think Peterson probably has the strongest chance of winning and then being a very credible candidate for that position. You know, a lot of folks are saying that, well, he's using this right now to raise money and also to position himself for AG, but, you know, that's par for the course. Half of the legislators are running for something, so that tends to be the norm.
Absolutely.
He's done a fairly good job. I think his caucus seems to be happy, as Republican caucuses tend to be. But, I think next year you're going to see him really be a formidable force. Particularly, you know, he's very good friends with Andy Biggs that we talked about earlier. I think them running as a team could be pretty impactful. And for Warren Peterson, because he has that organization that's already built in with Biggs, that's going to help him significantly.
That's a great point you bring up. That team could make a big difference. So, as always, I appreciate all your insight, appreciate what you do up there. Thank you for spending the time with us, and I look forward to having you back soon.
Thank you very much, Ted. I always like being on with both of you. Appreciate it.
All right, Jaime, you have a great day. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell, your host. Matt Neely behind the glass. That was a pretty good interview, Matt. It's amazing how much we continue talking off the air as well, but it's like some things never change.
Right. And the jockeying already beginning for an election that is a year and a half away. It's just amazing.
It is a continual process, and I've talked about that a lot before, where I think the two-year cycle is brutal, and it's not good for our country. I mean, you look at what members of Congress face. We're still over a year and a half away, and everything you read about Congressman Sisciamati is about his race, and we need to get rid of him, and he needs to, it's just a continual cycle. If people don't understand that, a lot of the information that's put out there, it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican, a lot of the information that's put out there is just trying to posture for the next election.
Sure.
18 months later.
Sure. Absolutely.
How can we ever get to the point where we can get things done?
So not only that, the incumbents also have to do things. And I'm not saying, any specific incumbent on any specific issue, but the incumbents have to do things to project certain,
exactly,
certain positions on things.
Yeah, it's just not.
And it's all gamesmanship coming up for an election.
Yeah, it's just not the people, putting stuff in the paper and talking and bringing it up. It's the actual electeds. They have to do gamesmanship, and you wonder how much that impacts what they could really do or would do. Some people don't like the structure of the Senate having 6 years. Once you're there for a while, and we can get into term limits and a whole bunch of other things. But the fact of the matter is, at least when you're in a 6-year cycle, you've got about 4 years that you could actually do what you think's right.
Be productive.
What you think is what everybody elected you to do. And then you can go into your 2-year campaign cycle.
Well, you're talking to a guy that's got a problem with the 17th Amendment, just to begin. If we're talking about the U.S. Senate, the direct election of senators, I've got a problem with, but I don't think that's ever going to be, that we're ever going to go back to
that. You don't think they're going to unravel that?
Right. Appointing senators.
Well, it's interesting. People forget that the whole concept when the founding fathers were bringing up is the Senate was going to be the professional side of the elected officials. That was going to be the professionals. And that's why it could be determined by the states, not by the citizens. We're a republic. We're set up structurally different. We can have a democracy, that debate, and there's a lot of people that think about it differently. But I think that's one of the things that holds the state back. One, we've got term limits at the state, but the fact is they're not really term limits because you can just turn around and run for the other house. And quite often you'll see districts where they have three people that will work back and forth to coordinate who's running next. And there's been talk about making the Senate a 4-year term, making again that kind of the senior house where people can maybe work forward to it. But our state legislatures are always, always running for office.
Yep, they sure are.
And that makes it difficult. So based on that, we're going to have a state legislature with us when we get legislator with us when we get back. We're going to be interviewing and talking to Kevin Volk, the Democrat representing LD-17. Good morning and welcome back. This is The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell, your host. Matt Neely's behind the glass, spinning the tunes and keeping me on target as well. The purpose, this is the engagement hour. Making the transition from the 1-hour show to the 2-hour show, we've kind of stretched the engagement hour to maybe the engagement 2 hours. But this interview we're about to do now is definitely a part of the purpose of the engagement hour, which is to encourage everyone to get involved. We have rights and responsibilities in this country, and we are a nation bound by shared values of freedom, liberty, and equality. And with that comes those rights and responsibilities. For some, that includes service to our country and others to our community. As I've stated a lot on this show, you can serve in so many different ways as a first responder, as a medical healthcare industry member, of an educator, for nonprofits, for your local community. And some people step up and they take that ultimate step and they serve as elected officials. So I'm very honored to be joined this morning by Kevin Volk. He's the one of the two state representatives from LD-17, which is the northeastern side of Pima County, and he is in his initial term. Kevin, I'm glad to have you join us today, and Representative, I really do appreciate it.
Glad to be here, Ted. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. We will get to the point about how you're finding the legislature and all that, but first part of the engagement hour, I always open up with hearing your stories and how you got engaged. Kevin, you are a local graduate, born and raised in Tucson. You're actually a Sal Point high school graduate.
Yep.
You've done a lot of public service, including being a fifth grade public school teacher. You interned for Gabby Giffords. You've been an English language educator in Mexico, and you even helped form Governor Tim Kaine's campaign for the Senate out in Virginia. And you've been a business person. You've worked in the business industry. Your family, the Volk Company, is very well known around here. As a matter of fact, some people said you had some free signage because everywhere you drive, you see Volk Company during your campaign. So it wasn't something you had to pay for. You've got a lot of experience. So tell me a little bit about your upbringing and what led you to getting this engaged, and ultimately then we'll cover your decision to run for office.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. Born and raised here in Southern Arizona, just outside of the Tucson city limits, which is mostly what District 17 is comprised of, from Marana through Dove Mountain, Oro Valley up to Saddlebrook, Catalina Mountains down to Tancredi Valley, Far East Tucson, Rita Ranch, and part of Vail. So similar to the district, grew up just outside of city limits and had a great childhood growing up in the Tucson area, and was lucky to go to fully funded public schools for elementary and middle school, had great educational experiences, and then continued on to Sal Point, where my dad and his seven brothers and sisters and my two older cousins had gone. So something of a family tradition that I followed. And as I got older and had this just incredible childhood in Tucson, I realized just how rare my experience, where I had access to every opportunity, just how rare that experience was, and really wanted to learn more about why other kids who were born in different situations didn't have access to that. And I came to the conclusion that in our unique system of self-government, which you alluded to at the introduction, there's a lot that is determined by elected officials. There's obviously a really important component from nonprofits, from the private sector that shape our society. But ultimately, really important decisions are made by our government, and in our government system, that's elected officials. So for me, that was something I identified early on as something that had an impact in determining who has access to what opportunities. I had access to every opportunity. I ended up going to college back east to get a different perspective and different experience, and then had some of those experiences you talked about. Wanted to give back, and my way of giving back was through Teach for America as a fifth grade teacher in a low income area, just in East San Jose, California. Went to Mexico to help teach English in central Mexico, Aguascalientes. And then my most official exposure to the political process and elected office was in the form of being an intern for Representative Gabby Giffords in 2009 during a very active summer where cap and trade and healthcare reform legislation was being discussed, and then also worked in politics directly for then Governor Tim Kaine's campaign for U.S. Senate. So my background was really a true Southern Arizona upbringing, but like many of us in this amazing community, I really cared about giving back and finding ways to do that. So that's ultimately what put me on this path towards elected office.
So I want to go back and thank you for serving in Teach for America. It's an incredible program. It's actually highly competitive. People don't always see that, but it's also an incredible experience for someone like yourself. So what would you say you took away from that experience of teaching fifth grade in a public school in east side of San Jose?
Great question. It was highly competitive, especially in those few years. There was a real desire to give back across the country, which was incredible to see. But my biggest takeaway was the understanding that all too often, some of us write off these kinds of communities, kids of color, kids from low-income background. And if they don't succeed at the same rate, we say, that's just the way it is. What I learned, beyond a shadow of a doubt, from my perspective, is that every single one of those kids has unlimited potential. And the only question is whether we as adults are going to create a system in which they have access to opportunities to be the best, most productive, most exciting and inspirational versions of themselves, or whether we're going to set up systems that give them a far too large chance of failure. But what I've learned working with those kids is that there's just unlimited potential to tap into. Our future is so bright, but it's only as bright as the opportunities that we facilitate for them. And those are the adults making those decisions, and that's what I aspire to be, is one of the adults that makes the decisions that grants them access to opportunities so they can be their best, most successful selves.
So there are a lot of different ways you can get involved, even through elections, local, state, you know, federal. You decide to run for a state representative position in LD-17, which is about a +9 Republican district, and you ran as a Democrat. What was your thought process in there, and then how did you focus on being successful in that race, which obviously you were?
Yeah. And sorry, had a Bluetooth issue. Can you hear me?
We've got you loud and clear.
Okay. Sorry about that. So yeah, great question. So the state, I feel like there are state level issues that are impacting people more acutely at the state level than at other levels. So one of those is education. Public education is obviously a passion of mine. I think it can and should be the great equalizer that gives folks socioeconomic opportunities to move up. That is the American dream. So public education is largely funded at a state level. There are some trends that are concerning about the direction of school funding and enrollment that I wanted to be a part of. Water, it was mentioned before, just a few minutes before we started on this segment. Water is a big deal. We have the Colorado River Compact negotiation coming up next year, and also in a very pressing situation, especially with our neighbors to the southeast in Cochise County. That is, to me, a crisis level issue that is largely governed at the state level. And then finally, we've got cost of living issues, foremost of which, for those who aren't lucky enough to have their mortgage locked in the good old days, housing is the biggest cost of living and is increasingly a reason for people to not move to Arizona or to consider moving out of Arizona, even if they would like to stay otherwise. So those three issues really strike me as issues that are addressed primarily at a state level. And for that reason, I got involved at the state level. In terms of running in the campaign, I think I've always been disappointed to see extreme partisanship rule the conversation on many of these issues. And my theory was that other people feel the same way. Arizona is unique in being a state where we see many more people who are independent and sophisticated when making their decisions of which candidates to support. They will actually split their ticket. And it's much more common here in Arizona, home of Maverick John McCain and others who have made a point of being independent in their decision making. And this district, District 17, is kind of a prototypical example of that, where people are willing to make the decision based off of what they feel to be most important and choose a candidate that they feel best reflects their position, regardless of party. So I went in with that theory and went in as myself, which is someone who is raised by in a household with one Democratic parent, one Republican parent. My extended family spans the whole political spectrum, the entire political spectrum, I think. And someone, I've just always been raised with the idea that there are lots of different ways to come to different conclusions. But someone from one party or another isn't inherently evil if they don't share your same viewpoints. And so I really tried to stress solving problems and a desire to work with anyone. That's who I am. And I tried to express that, and it ended up being successful in the campaign.
Well, one more question before we go to the break, because you kind of just gave us a little insight to your family. So now that you're an elected official on one side of the partisan aisles, but willing to work across, obviously, how have your family get-togethers and dinners changed on the politics? Is it, do you talk more about it now, or do you talk less about it?
No, we talk about the same. Obviously, there's curiosity about the actual experience of being in elected office. Oftentimes, we have perceptions of people from afar who are part of elected office, and we view them from, you know, secondhand information, or view them from the impressions we get from the media or snippets. And so for people, whether it's family or friends, I think they're just mostly interested in getting to know what it's actually like now that they know someone who's in it, and it's not this foreign concept where they feel separated, which I think is what your show is rightly looking to do, is demystify the whole process and bring people, our ideal of an engaged citizenry, closer to elected officials, not farther away. So I think they just jump into that. They've got obviously a unique level of access to now an elected official, and then hearing my thoughts on what it's like.
Well, I appreciate that, Representative. And we're going to take a break now. When we come back, we'll get into the topic of your first legislative session and how things worked out. So please stay with us and join us after the break. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell, and my guest this morning is State Representative Kevin Volk, representing LD-17, which is my district as well. So, Representative, first term in office, first session of your two-year term, how's it going?
Yeah, great question. So it's been just over 3 months, but we voted on 525 bills so far. So there's been a lot going on. A number of things have gone through in a very bipartisan way. There's a lot that we do at the state legislature that is not inherently partisan, that is clerical, administrative fixes, things that have been brought to us by constituents that we want to get enacted. But I'll just talk briefly about a couple of my focuses and my legislation. I've introduced a number of bills, from education to federal funding. One of the bills I introduced was on behalf of my former running mate he was running for the state Senate in Legislative District 17, John McClain, who is a great man who tragically was killed in a drunk driving accident 10 days after the campaign. So I introduced legislation that would, in severe cases like that, where someone was previously convicted of a drunk driving offense, it would increase the penalties for those who knowingly lend their vehicles in a way to try to decrease the chances that this tragedy ever happened again. And I was pleased that made it through committee in a very bipartisan way. also have a bill to allow electric vehicle owners to get a specialty plate of their choosing and not be forced to have the cloud plate or the alternative fuel vehicle plate that they're now mandated to get. And that passed through committee and through the House as well. Largely, though, I talked about the main issues that got into this. There's a, you know, structurally, the majority party sets the agenda, and so they determine what goes through, what hasn't. I approach this job as, you know, I feel like I was elected not to be a complete partisan on one side or the other, but rather to do things that are in the best interest of the district and the best interest of Arizona and really solve problems. That's what people want to see from elected office. They don't want to see talk. They don't want to see partisanship. They don't want to see extremism. They want to see solving problems. So in the course of my first term, been a learning process, obviously, on how legislation works, the quirks of the processes. I've also taken a lot of time to get to know and develop relationships with members on both sides of the aisle. And I'm pleased to have good relationships with a variety of folks on both sides of the aisle. And just looking back in what we've done so far, 525 bills later, there's things that we have done. And then, unfortunately, there are things that we haven't made much progress on. Water was mentioned prior to this program. We haven't made significant progress on a solution for what's going on in Cochise County, where there's been a bipartisan water council that's proposed the Rural Groundwater Management Act. That is something that's tailored for that type of area that will actually get water usage under control so that family farms and families in that area don't have wells that are being sucked dry by out-of-state and sometimes out-of-country interests. We haven't seen real progress on child care, which coming from the business community is something that's increasingly important to the business community for recruitment and retention of employees and just letting people be in the workforce if they want to be. And so, unfortunately, we haven't seen some significant progress on some of those issues, but it's been an absolute learning experience. I'm honored to serve the people of District 17 and absolutely doing my best to work with anyone to get things done, talking with and working with folks across the aisle whenever the opportunity presents itself.
Well, I appreciate you, you know, talking about the bills that you were the primary sponsor. I think you've had almost 10 bills that you were the primary sponsor on. And the ones that are moving forward that have gone, like the alternate fuel vehicles bill, what do you believe? Do you believe you're going to have an opportunity to get some of the bills that you were the prime sponsor for actually into law this year once we get out of the current stalemate that's occurring up at the legislature?
You know, it completely depends. I do as much as I can to make sure that happens, but it's completely dependent on the Republican majority leadership's decision. They are inherently bipartisan bills, and so there's not a partisan reason that they shouldn't go through. There's not a policy reason that they shouldn't go through. But I can't speak to the decision that leadership will ultimately make. I'm grateful that they've gotten as far as they have. That's somewhat rare for a minority lawmaker, especially a freshman lawmaker. So I'm proud of the progress they have made, but I'm going to keep on working to do everything I can to make sure they're enacted, because I don't believe that they're partisan policy from a policy perspective. I do think they would be helpful in the case of the electric vehicle plate, you know, giving people the freedom to not only have expression of their car. We love specialty plates in Arizona, but also giving those beneficiary organizations the ability to get the revenue. When you buy a specialty plate, $17 goes to the beneficiary organization, whether that's the U of A, whether that's 4-H organization, which was recently added, whether that's for education, whether that's for pets and animal adoption. There's so many great causes. So I'm going to keep working on them. I'm proud of the progress they've made. I'm thankful that they were able to be heard in committee and on the floor. And I'm going to keep on working until the session is over. So that's what I'll do. And then the rest is up to other folks.
Well, I appreciate your openness in talking about it. You prevented us from having to talk about Howdy because you filled it in with all the other stuff that you actually are getting moving. So we won't do that. And I also want to mention Specialty Plates, the Empower Coalition, a great organization I support around here that supports the military. And they actually, those funds that come in from the Specialty Plates is what's kind of knocking it out of the park for them. And it's turning a lot of their focus to bigger and better things they can do. So I appreciate the support on trying to capture that in the electric vehicle section. We will
absolutely.
It's good to be successful. We'll be right back after this bottom of the hour break, and we'll talk about what you see going forward. So you're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Stay with us, and we'll be back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell, and my guest this morning is Kevin Volk, the state representative for LD, one of the two state representatives for LD 17. So, Kevin, I know you texted me during the thing saying, hey, now you want to talk about Howdy. I mean, if you want, but I love the idea that we were talking about bills that had, but I know sometimes it's a challenge. As a freshman legislature, like you said, these have gone a long way, and you're always looking to get one signed as in the minority party. So
well, you mentioned it. So now we have to talk about it. But so this is something that that is designed to be a little bit more lighthearted. But it gets to the point we're talking about with the structure of the state legislature, where if the majority even has a one seat majority as they have for the previous 4 years. They control the speakership, they control the chairs of the committees, they control which bills get on the agenda and which get any hearing at all. So there's just a complete structural disadvantage for the 27 out of 60 folks from the minority party across the state who were duly elected. It's just much tougher for them to get their bills heard. But Howdy was designed to be a kind of a lighthearted way to get a conversation going so we can highlight some of the incredible Western-related tourism draws we have in Arizona, including the White Stallion Ranch in Marana and the Tancredi Ranch. And it actually worked. It was picked up by an El Paso radio station that was miffed that someone would even propose that Howdy be the state greeting of Arizona and not Texas. And so they did an article about it and then listed the Arizona tourism draws that are related to Howdy. So I had some fun with it. Hopefully other people had fun with it. It was not one of the bills that I spent a lot of time on, but I know it got picked up. So
there's a little of that business coming out in you. So you recognized it and it apparently worked. I don't know. I haven't been watching. I do watch the state legislature here for my other job as well, but I haven't been watching the Texas state legislature. So I don't know if they're going to try to get that from you before you can ingrain it.
Maybe, but anything we can do to get more revenue to fund services, whether it's state highway patrol, whether it's public education, whether it's transportation, road funding, anything we can do that's voluntary, whether it's bringing tourism dollars in from other people coming in, or whether it's through specialty plates directly to beneficiary organizations at the discretion of people who are registering their vehicles, I'm always going to try to get creative on how to fill our coffers in ways that make sense and can fund vital services. So that one was just one of the more fun ways to go about getting creative, which we have to do.
It definitely got you some attention, no doubt. So, Representative, we got about 5 minutes left. We're kind of at a standstill on some things going on in the state legislature. Obviously, not a lot of bills being heard because the governor's got the veto stamp waiting until you address the disability funding. That's become a concern. What do you see playing out in the short term and for the long term of getting to a successful budget before you guys can recess?
Yeah, so here's one of the frustrations, and I don't know that I know I'm new to the chamber, new to this role, but I don't know that I'll lose this frustration with the body. There are times when politics takes the reins, and we do things in what I would call a very non-business-like manner. So we learned about the need for more funding for the Division of Developmentally Disabled back in late January. And then there was a proposal to do a clean supplemental funding bill in late January, early February. And then 2 months went by without anything. So we finally have a counter proposal from Republicans, and now we're right up against the deadline, which might be good for a negotiating perspective, but it's been horrible for the care community, the employers, the providers, and then some of the families who've been stepping up as caregivers. So I am confident we're going to come up with a solution that funds the DDD program. But the process is just really inexcusable in my mind. It was needlessly partisan. It was needlessly delayed. And while I'm optimistic it's going to get done, I just really resent the fact that we pushed the timeline out, which increased the sense of desperation for this very vulnerable community that should not be in this position. So related to that, the budget is one of the obviously most important duties of the state legislature. We have not started significant, there have not been significant conversations to this point on the budget. That's something I also think should get started at the beginning of session. I will say the economic picture is changing. The federal government, the Trump administration, has been very erratic and reckless in their decision making. I join everyone else in hoping that there is some sort of plan behind it, but it seems like there's no plan. The decisions have been withdrawn and rescinded and partially held back. It's creating huge global economic uncertainty, and that does have an effect on our budget. Arizona is one of the top receiver states. We get about $30 billion from the federal government. So whether it's some of the contemplated extreme federal funding cuts, like $880 billion from Medicaid, or the overall economic global uncertainty, we're seeing turmoil in the markets, the budget picture is changing. And we're going to have to get more data in before we make that final decision on what the budget looks like. So unfortunately, politics is playing a significant role both in the Division of Developmentally Disabled funding bill that needs to get sorted as soon as possible, and it politics from the federal level especially is playing a significant role in what would ordinarily be a more standard Arizona state budget picture.
Well, on the earlier session, we had Jaime Molera with Molera Alvarez on, and he spoke to the recent economist prediction that it's going to drop from a $612 million surplus to less than $200 million. That's going to cause some decisions made at the legislature. So I hope you're right, and I hope you're able to work through that.
I hope we pull back from the brink and can restore a normal economy that gets back to the focus of bringing costs down for Arizonans instead of jacking them up and assuring them that there's a plan despite all indications of the contrary. But it does look like it's going to be a different budget picture. I'm ready to work on it. I've been ready to work on the budget from, you know, the day I got sworn in. So I'm ready to go and work in a bipartisan way as soon as that conversation gets started.
Well, that's the voice of Representative Kevin Volk, representing LD-17 at the state legislature. And, sir, appreciate you joining us today, and I do look forward to having you on again.
Thank you for having me, Ted.
All right, everybody, you're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. When we come back, we'll have Stephen Levine from RJP Estate Planning to talk to us with how you can secure your future. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. I encourage everyone to tune in every day to listen to The Morning Voice from 7 to 9 a.m. on 10:30 a.m. on the dial. And tomorrow, please tune in to listen to Grant Kruger, who brings a unique perspective on the food situation inside the region, as well as a little politics. He's always got a great show going on. So if you're counting on your assets going straight to your loved ones when you pass away, your family could be in for an unpleasant surprise. But luckily today we have Stephen Levine with RJP Planning with us today to shed some light on this. Good morning, Stephen.
Morning, Ted. How are you?
I'm doing well this morning. So do people still believe their assets will just go to their family automatically when they die?
Yeah, a lot of people do. They still do. Many people assume that everything will just kind of work itself out. But the truth is, when you pass away, your home, your life savings, all of it could go to one of two places. Number one, to the people you love, or to probate court. So where the government basically decides who gets what. There are legal steps you have to follow. Sadly, we see people try to take shortcuts without realizing the big risk. Like the woman who called in recently, she was in her 70s, I think, a widow. She added her daughter as a joint account owner at her bank and on her home deed. We see this a lot. It's very common. People think that it helps, having somebody on the account right now. That way, if you're incapacitated, you pass away, that person can help pay the bills, make things easier when you pass. But then everything went wrong. It goes wrong a lot. We see all the time. One example is a client did that, and her daughter's husband racked up a bunch of debt. When creditors couldn't collect from him, who do they go after? They go after the wife. Since the wife was listed as a joint owner on her mom's bank account, creditors found it. And in Arizona, community property state, everything gained or owned during a marriage is shared equally between spouses. That includes assets and debts. So even though all the money in the mother's bank account was originally hers, things changed the moment she added her daughter to the joint account. And because her daughter was married, her name was on the account, and that exposed the account and her mom's money to the husband's debt. So that's how her son-in-law's creditors were able to claim half of the mother's money.
And that's absolutely terrible. And I bet most parents wouldn't even think of that. Are there ways to prevent this?
Yeah, so the best way is if the mom had created a living trust, her daughter could have inherited everything later without having to owe money to creditors from the mom's account. At RJP Estate Planning, we've helped more than 40,000 families in Arizona for three decades, and that's why we can offer living trusts that are so affordable. So I'll remind listeners, if you're over 60, we offer a 65% discount on living trust. So that includes financial power of attorney. If the mother had an RJP living trust package, the daughter could have helped pay bills without being a legal owner on the bank account because she would have had the power of attorney documents. So that would have protected the account, and she wouldn't have lost half the money to the son-in-law's creditors. Also, the living trust package is there for when the mom passes away. The trust would have avoided probate. Everything would have gone directly to the daughter. We were able to help protect a lot of families with living trust, but we couldn't recover what was already lost with clients like that, unfortunately, that don't have a trust.
So even if people's intentions are good, it can go sideways very fast. Are there other risks to adding your kids to your bank accounts or to your home deeds?
Yeah, so one risk is divorce. I mean, that's another. It's a community property state. Half the money goes to the spouse. So we had a client that was a man, and same thing. He put his adult son on his bank accounts and the house. When the son went through a divorce, the ex-wife attorney found the joint bank accounts, found the house. They tried to claim 50% of the money because it's joint accounts. Both names are seen as equal owners. And even if one person didn't put a single dollar in, they're still a joint owner, and that money's vulnerable.
That sounds really similar to the story about the widow. Anyone who's been through this has to be surprised and in shock.
Yep. Yeah, and there's one more situation people don't think about as well is we have clients all the time that they come in, they you know, we build a trust form. We're helping them fund the trust. I say, hey, make sure you make the trust the owner or beneficiary of the bank account. Make sure we put the house into the trust. Some people don't realize. They say, well, hey, if I do a POD or if I, you know, transfer on death or a beneficiary deed to this one child, that won't go through probate, will it? And I said, well, it might not go through probate, but the problem is if you have multiple kids and you have one child that's the POD on the bank account, yeah, you might hope that that child gets the money and then helps pay for, you know, bills and then splits the money with the sibling. But the problem is legally, once that money goes or that house goes to that beneficiary, it's theirs. They're not obligated to split it. Whereas in a living trust basically says, no, these are the rules. There's two beneficiaries, three beneficiaries, four, the money goes to the trust as a kind of a funnel first, and then it's split. So, shortcuts like joint accounts or even do-it-yourself plans can leave your family a legal mess, but a living trust avoids probate, protects your wishes, and gives peace of mind to the family ultimately.
Stephen, you mentioned a special discount for people 60 and older. What does that include?
Yeah, so first my message to the listeners is don't wait until something happens, you know, an unexpected illness, an accident, or passing away suddenly. Obviously, none of these unexpected events give you the time to plan. So, yep, like I said, if you're 60 or older, RJP offers a 65% discount on a full living trust package. That includes a trust, has the built-in will, financial power of attorney, medical power of attorney to protect your assets and medical decisions while you're alive. But if you're mentally incapacitated, helps direct your healthcare wishes and appointing your agent who you trust to make those decisions. You'll also get free annual reviews, legal updates. And to me, the most important part of the package is helping your loved ones after you pass away, kind of holding their hands, giving them guidance. We'll guide them through the process so they can get their inheritance quickly without any court involvement. So yeah, give us a call to lock in your 65% discount. Call RJP at 520-441-4523 by this Thursday, April 24th to get scheduled. So 520-441-4523.
So you heard it here. If you don't have an estate plan, now is the time. Don't leave your family with court battles and confusion. And if you're 60 or over, call 520-441-4523 by this Thursday to lock in your 65% savings on a living trust package from RJP Estate Planning. That's 520-441-4523, 520-441-4523. Stephen, as always, we appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights and your experiences with our listeners.
Yes, sir. Thanks, Dad. Have a great week.
Have a great week. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye.
Well, Matt, that kind of brings us to a close on the show, but there's one thing we haven't talked about.
Uh-oh.
The thing we haven't talked about is the greatest sport action of all time is the Stanley Cup playoffs.
All right.
So I don't know if you're
a
hockey
fan. That's a bold claim.
I don't know if you're a hockey fan, but it just changes. The season can play out throughout, but you get into the playoffs, and all of a sudden it becomes about the passion of winning. It gets more physical. It gets more tight. It doesn't matter how. 16 of the 30-plus teams, mm-hmm. 16 of the 32 teams make the playoffs. But an 8 seed beating a 1 seed, it happens all the time. And most importantly, last night the Los Angeles Kings won Game 1
oh, really?
Of their 7-set series against the Edmonton Oilers.
Okay.
Now, the Oilers have a phenomenal team. They've got Connor McDavid.
It's like the 80s all over again.
But back then, it was a lot about the fighting.
Sure,
now it's about
sure.
the skill. And uh-huh. the Oilers have some of the best skaters in the league. But the Kings built a 4-0 lead, gave up two goals. Within 32 seconds. With the Edmonton Oilers goalie pulled to force 5-5, and it looked like it was heading to overtime.
Wow.
But the Kings put a goal in
there. So they wanted an extra person shooting the puck.
Yes. Yeah. And the Kings took at least 4 shots almost the full length of the ice, missing the open net, which results in coming back into icing and back into the Kings zone. And I mean, I was watching that game obviously grew up in LA, huge Kings fan, melting as was going away. And literally 42 seconds left when they dropped the puck again, and the Kings scored with like 31 seconds left to take a 6-5 lead and win the game.
I'll
so
be.
This 4-0 overcome, 4-goal deficit that the Oilers overcame still resulted in the Kings getting the win.
Wow.
Now, I say that now. I'm not hopeful yet. We'll see how the rest of the series turns out. But playoff hockey's incredible. So if anybody's interested in getting exposed to the game of hockey, now is the time to turn in and watch the games. They're fast, they're action-oriented, and it's incredible. There's been a lot of good news about going on at the U of A as well. We'll come back to that and probably get our sports fixed next week at this time as well. So appreciate everybody tuning in this morning with us on The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell, been your host, and I truly value you listening to us. Please tune in next week and tune in tomorrow for Grant Krueger. Have a great week.